Bartek Cech, Lavrus Lavru, Ben Mosk, and James Sully. And there's also some related work by these authors here. So the question that I want to discuss today is, how do we see into the bulk in the context of ADS-CFT? So in particular, we have our ADS universe with our dual CFT. We're living on the boundary. So how do we determine the structure of that ADS universe if we're sitting there at the boundary? So I'll start off with an analogy, which is actually a rather precise analogy. The question is, how do we determine the inner structure of the Earth? So how do you do this? You could either dig for a long time, but that would take too long, and probably your machines would melt if you did that. But the way we actually do this is using travel time tomography. So if there's an earthquake on one side of the Earth, then we have this. All right, I won't use that. I'll use this instead. If there's an earthquake on one side of the Earth, then we have a system of stations set up all around that can measure when that earthquake is felt on different places in the Earth, and can measure how much time it takes for the vibrations to propagate from one side of the Earth to the other. And using this information, it turns out you can reconstruct the density profile of the Earth. This is exactly how we know about the inner structure of the Earth. And for another example, how do we determine the inner structure of a person? Well, you could do surgery, but instead we have X-ray tomography. So this is a CT scan machine here. You can send rays through a person and do a 3D reconstruction of the their inner structure. So I want to do the same thing, but I want to do this for our ADS universe. So take our ADS universe here and put it into the CT scan machine, and use those probes to understand the structure of the ADS universe. And what I'll argue is that we should formulate a theory of gravity in ADS in terms of probes, rather than in terms of local objects. So it's long been known that the building blocks of quantum gravity are likely not to be local objects. They're not diffeomorphism invariant. And with a fluctuating metric, it's hard to pin down a point. So we expect that it should be formulated in terms of some kind of extended probes rather than local fields. But if this is true, then in the context of ADS-CFT, those probes should be fundamental objects on both sides of duality, just like particles and vortices in particle-vortex duality. Those are fundamental objects on both sides. So we should make use of the ADS-CFT duality to find what these building blocks are going to be. Now, we have some examples of this already. So, for example, the quantum entropy is given, the quantum entropy of a CFT subregion is given via the Ryu-Takenagi formula in terms of the area of a minimal surface plus a correction due to the bulk entanglement entropy. But also Wilson loops in the CFT, scalar eigenvalues. All of these things are dual to some more non-local objects in the bulk. But it's not clear how these objects all conspire to give you a theory that behaves like a local theory in the bulk. So not every CFT should have a local ADS dual. So we need to understand how locality emerges in that context. So the first step there will be to understand just how to construct local operators in terms of extended objects instead. So I'm gonna use the question of bulk reconstruction to approach this. So please stop me for any questions. Okay, so let me give a brief review of the bulk reconstruction problem, the basic bulk reconstruction problem in ADS-CFT. So let's take some free field in ADS, let's call it phi, that obeys a Klein-Gordon equation with mass squared m squared. Then the ADS-CFT dictionary will relate that field, some CFT operator on the boundary. So if z is our coordinate that measures the distance from the boundary, then as we take our field towards the boundary, then the bulk field will just approach the CFD operator. So this is just some boundary value problem. If we want to determine what is the field on the inside of ADS in terms of these boundary values, this is just some boundary value problem. But it's not a standard boundary value problem. The standard kind of boundary value problems we're used to involve specifying initial data on a space-like surface. But here we have a time-like surface. So let me tell you what the standard answer is here. The standard construction is called the HKLL construction, Hamilton, Kabat, Lifshitz, and Lowe, but also understood by other authors. The standard result is that this bulk field is written as a smeared boundary field, where O is the operator that's dual to this bulk field. And by smeared, I just mean integrated with some kernel over some region in the CFD. So in the case I've shown here, it's just integrated over all points that are space-like separated from that bulk point. And that smearing function, this kernel we'll call the smearing function, it's essentially determined by brute force from the bulk mode expansion. So the remaining questions I want to answer are, how is this local operator constructed from gauge invariant observables that actually see into the bulk rather than just things sitting on the boundary and brute force solving the equation of motion? And what we'll see is that making use of kinematic space, the formalism of integral geometry will give us some insight here. So we'll take this non-standard Cauchy problem where the initial data is specified on a surface with a time direction, and we'll transform it into a new problem in what I'll define as kinematic space, the space of geodesics, the space of probes. And there it will become a standard Cauchy problem, and we can solve this using standard methods. So let me tell you the plan here. So first I'll define for you what is kinematic space. It's a phase space for gravitational probes. I'll tell you about its geometrical structure and define fields on it. And I'll tell you how to use this formalism to construct bulk local operators. And I'll also tell you how these extended probes appear naturally on both sides of the ADS-CFD duality. So we'll see how the local bulk operator emerges from something very simple on the CFD side. And it'll come from a fundamental object in the CFD, which is the operator product expansion. And then depending on time, I'll go through some generalizations and applications. I'll tell you how the modular Hamiltonian is a special case of this formalism. I'll introduce the vacuum modular Hamiltonian in a CFD and the relationship to Einstein equation. I'll tell you how this whole story generalizes to higher dimensions. I'll start in the case of ADS3 CFD2, just for simplicity, but the whole story will generalize to higher dimensions. And we'll see there that surface operators really appear as fundamental objects in this understanding of CFD and ADS. And then I'll talk briefly about the inclusion of interactions and the dressing of operators. So let me first start by telling you about integral geometry. So integral geometry is a mathematical field that studies spaces in terms of extended probes. It's exactly what we want to do here. So we introduced this object that we called kinematic space. This is a space of oriented space like geodesics in some manifold. So it's a space of probes. So this is our kinematic space. You can ignore what it looks like right now, even though it looks kind of De Sitter-like, but we'll see that's not precisely true. But we'll define this space so that a point in the kinematic space corresponds to a geodesic in real space, an oriented geodesic. And because it's an oriented geodesic, I've actually drawn an extra point here, this shadowy point here. And so these two points correspond to this one geodesic, but the two points give you opposite orientations to the geodesic. So you should think of this as like as a phase space for non-local bulk observables. This will be our phase space. Don't necessarily think of this as some real space with a real theory in it, but more like a phase space.
So when you say phase space, you mean you have a symplectic
structure? That is what I mean, and I also mean to think of another way to specify coordinates on this space will be to say, pick a point on the boundary here and pick a momentum. So you have like a position and a momentum, and you can make that more precise as well. And define a symplectic structure on here. It's known as the Crofton form in integral geometry. We can discuss that more later if you're interested. Yeah. Any other questions? Okay. So now that I've defined this space for you, let me define what's called the geodesic X-ray transform. This is also studied in integral geometry. This is a transform that takes a function on real space to a function on kinematic space. So it's some integral transform. The way it does this is by integrating over geodesics. So it's very simple. So if I start with some function on real space, and I ask for the value of this X-ray transform that I'll denote as R of f, the value at this point is just given by the integral of the original function over this geodesic. And it turns out that this transform is invertible in many cases. Though explicit inversion formulas are only known in a few special cases, such as hyperbolic space and flat space. But it is known to be invertible in some large class of spaces. So let me give you one example there. So let's take this original manifold to be the hyperbolic disk, hyperbolic two space. Then let's pick coordinates on our kinematic space, the kinematic space for hyperbolic two space. And let's just choose them to be the coordinate of the midpoint, theta, and the opening angle of that geodesic, so theta and alpha. So it's a two-dimensional space in this case, the kinematic space. And so the X-ray transform is going to be a function of two variables. So that's our definition of the X-ray transform. We integrate over the geodesic corresponding to this midpoint and opening angle. And so here's the inversion formula for this specific case. You can find this in a very nice book by Helgeson. And it's relatively simple. So if we want to find the value of our original function at some point, let's say this point in the center, then we'll average the X-ray transform, average that over all geodesics that are a given distance from the point we're interested in, and then apply take a derivative, do some integral over that distance. And so this will give you back the value of the function at that point. And this formula actually works in higher dimensions as written, but it turns out that in odd dimensions, it simplifies a little bit further, that rather than needing all geodesics, so here I've integrated over all distances from the original point, rather than needing all the geodesics, you only need ones in some neighborhood of the point that almost intersect the point. But this is the context that I'll be using this formula to. We could also make this covariant in say ADS3 by averaging over slices. So again, we'll just be integrating over all geodesics that are given distance from the point we're interested in. And by the way, I mean the distance, when I say the distance between a point and the geodesic, I just mean the minimum distance over all points on that geodesic to this point. All right. So in order to take our original Cauchy problem and transform it to a new one on kinematic space, what we'll need are equations of motion for this X-ray transform. And so, but first to do that, we'll need to fix a metric on this kinematic space, on this phase space of geodesics. That'll be a distance function on this space of geodesics. Okay. And so it turns out that for the case of where our original manifold is highly symmetric, it's a homogeneous space, such as hyperbolic space or ADS, then the kinematic space corresponding to that original space is also highly symmetric. In other words, every geodesic we map to some other geodesic by some isometry. Then in that case, we'll be able to fix a unique metric on that space. So let's do that. So we'll do that using conformal symmetry. So we'll use the isometries of ADS or hyperbolic space to pick this metric. Now let's pick coordinates on this kinematic space. So the simplest coordinates for the space of geodesics are just the coordinates for the two endpoints. So a single point in kinematic space has coordinates that correspond to the location of the two different endpoints of the geodesic. So now the metric is just the distance between this geodesic and some nearby one. So I'm going to move these two endpoints a little bit. Now, the metric has to have this form. Ds squared is some tensor dotted with dx mu dy nu. So I left out the dx mu dx nu term. The reason for that is if I only move one of these points, and I don't move the other, so set dy to 0 and just move dx, then I only have three points to make use of to define this distance function. But if I only have three points to make use of, there are no conformally invariant cross ratios that can be constructed of this 3 points. So I have to set that to 0, and I'm left with only this dx mu dy nu term. And now once we've said that, we can fix the form of this tensor just using conformal symmetry. So scaling, translation, inversion. And this is the result. Just some function of x and y here. And it turns out that if you work on CFT, it turns out that this is just the CFT two-point function of vector fields of dimension one. And that's just because it has to transform in the same way as a vector field two-point function. But this is our result here. So let's unpack this a little bit more. So we wrote down this metric, but let's see that this is actually become something simpler in the case of ADS3. So this was a result for any dimension, but now let's restrict to the case of ADS3 CFT2 to make this simpler. So the nice coordinates to choose here will be the midpoint of the causal diamond that is suspended by these 2 points. So these two endpoints. And the two different half widths in the left moving and the right moving light-like direction. So it's called z, z bar, and l, l bar. So it's just half the distance between those points. And if you just do that coordinate transformation on this metric, you'll find that you'll find something very simple, which is just a product of two-dimensional de Sitter spaces. So one corresponding to the left movers and one corresponding to the right movers. And now L and L bar are playing the role of time directions. Time directions, multiple. There's two time directions here, one for L and one for L bar. And that's true in general dimension as well. There will always be D space and D time directions in this kinematic space. It's a bit strange, but we can work with it. And in particular, if I restrict myself to just geodesics that lie on some time slice, so pick some time slice here, and make sure the 2 points both lie on that time slice, then we're just setting L equals L bar, Z equals Z bar, and we're left with just the diagonal two-dimensional de Sitter space. So the kinematic space for hyperbolic space. Hyperbolic 2 space is just going to be a single de Sitter space. But the kinematic space for ADS3 is going to be this product of two de Sitter spaces. Now, the causal structure here is going to be very important for us. That's what's going to make this Cauchy problem easier to solve than the original one. So the causal structure here is given by containment of causal diamonds. So if I start with some geodesic, then there's some causal diamond that's associated with it. If I make that causal diamond bigger, then I'm going into the future in kinematic space. And if I make it smaller, I'm going into the past. Now, there's two time directions, so it's kind of funny to define a causal structure. But what I mean by causal structure here is just an ordering. So not necessarily just saying time-like is going to be either the future or the past, but really just an ordering here. And so the ordering I want to make use of is just the containment relation of causal diamonds. And the reason I just care about the ordering is because I want to define a propagator, the causal propagator. We can, and by causal propagator, I just mean it vanishes when the two points are not causally connected.
So unlike usual space, there's no absolute ordering.
Say again?
There's no absolute, there's sometimes you cannot order.
Yeah, so you can't, so there will be plenty of points that are just not connected, not causally related at all. So if I start with some diamond and then shrink it in one direction and enlarge it in the other direction, I wouldn't call that, even though it's a time-like direction in kinematic space, it doesn't correspond to either future or past. Is that what you were asking? Yeah. Any other questions about this?
Is there any reason you want to pick out especially one as future and the other as past, or is it symmetric between the two?
So, good. So I forgot to mention here, but I want to define past so that the asymptotic past of this space is the boundary of ADS. So when I say asymptotic past, I mean the set of kinematic space points that have no predecessors. So those will just be points. So infinitely small causal diamonds are just points on the boundary. And so I can identify this asymptotic past with the boundary of ADS. So you can see this product of these two boundaries here gives you ADS. OK, it looks like I'm just talking about a product of two circles. ADS is, the boundary of ADS is not a product of two circles. So there's really some unwinding here as I go around the two visitors. But that's just the usual story of the starting with the compactified ADS and then decompactifying the time direction. But yeah, that's why I want to choose past so that it corresponds to just the points in the CFP. And that'll be important. Okay. So here's our structure of kinematic space, just to summarize. A geodesic in ADS is going to correspond to two points in kinematic space. And by one point in kinematic space, I have to, for one point in kinematic space, I have to represent it by two different coordinates on two de Sitters because it's four-dimensional space now. And then also it's the point corresponding to the other orientation. And these correspond to causal diamonds. These also correspond to causal diamonds in the CFT. And for any causal diamond, there's some corresponding complementary causal diamond. So this is our structure we're going to be dealing with. So now that we've defined the metric and understood the structure here, we'd like to find some equation of motion for this X-ray transform field. So it turns out there will be two equations of motion. I'll tell you where they come from, but first I'll tell you the answer. The first will be a Laplace equation, and the second will be a constraint equation. So we need two equations of motion for the two time directions. Now, the Laplace equation will come from this intertwining relation here. And by intertwining relation, I just mean if I take the X-ray transform of the Laplacian of some function, then that will be equal to minus the kinematic space Laplacian of the X-ray transform. This is an intertwining relation of these operators. And what we'll also find is there's some constraint, some differential operator that when acting on the X-ray transform just annihilates the X-ray transform of any function. So this will tell us that starting with some equation of motion for a field in ADS3, we'll find these two equations of motion. One that comes out from this intertwining relation, and one comes from the constraint. And now that, and I realize I didn't say before, but sort of the magic of this transformation is that now the boundary data is going to be specified on this asymptotic pass. But now this asymptotic pass is just a totally space-like surface. So we started with the CFT that had a space direction and a time direction, but now the boundary which is associated with the CFT only sees is only a space-like surface. So that makes this a standard Cauchy problem. Okay. Let me tell you where these equations come from quickly, so the details aren't too important. The point is that if I shift the function, shift my original function by some isometry of ADS, just shift the function, then I could correspondingly have shifted the X-ray transform in kinematic space to undo this shifting. And by putting these together, you get an intertwining relation between the differential operators that represent all of these symmetries. So I'll denote them L, A, B. These are differential operators, so the representation either in ADS or in kinematic space. And if I interchange these with the X-ray transform, then I just go from one representation to the other. And the minus sign is just a convention. And now if I just do this twice, I get L squared intertwines with R. And L squared is the Casimir of the conformal group. And that's just represented by the Laplacian in either of these cases. So the Laplacians intertwine. But and also using these differential operators, I can construct this differential operator out of the representation on the kinematic space. And you may recognize this as just H minus H bar, just the spin of an operator in CFT2. And so this has to annihilate this X-ray transform. If I took the X-ray transform of some object that wasn't a scalar, so I defined a new kind of transform for tensors, then this would no longer be true. So this comes from the fact that we started with the scalar. And the reason this had to be true is that we started with a function of 3 variables, but our result is a function of 4 variables, because ADS3 is 3-dimensional and kinematic space was 4. So I needed some kind of equation to reduce the dimensionality by 1. In other words, I told you that you can invert the X-ray transform on any hyperbolic 2 slice. So if I just gave you the geodesics that were unboosted, so all the geodesics that lie on one of these slices here, and then you could already use that inversion formula to get the value of, to get the field on any slice. Now you have the field everywhere, and you could integrate that over any boosted geodesic. So just the unboosted geodesics were sufficient to determine the whole function. So there's a similar result in flat space, known as John's equation, that we generalized here. Okay. So now that we've done that, we have our equations of motion for a field in kinematic space. We can also check the boundary conditions. So I already told you the boundary conditions for the field in real space. I can just integrate that over a tiny geodesic, find the boundary conditions in kinematic space. And they look the same. So now we can just solve this equation. This is now a standard Cauchy problem. And we find that the geodesic operator depends only on the boundary values. The boundary operator in the causal diamond it depends. In other words, what are the points in the asymptotic past of some geodesic in kinematic space? It's just all the points in the causal diamond it depends. So let's solve it. So solve this equation, and the result is a smeared operator on the causal diamond. And this is our result. So the integral of a field over a geodesic in ADS is given by the integral of the corresponding CFT operator over the causal diamond it subtends with some function here. So that's our answer. Okay. And by the way, I emphasized earlier that there's 2 different orientations. So this means there's actually choices for the causal diamond. There's 2 different representations for this geodesic operator, one on one side and one on the complementary causal diamond. So that'll be important. So now let's do the final step. Let's use these to get a local bulk operator. So all we need to do is plug our answer for the geodesic operator in, and invert into this inversion formula, and integrate over the appropriate geodesics. And now for each geodesic, we get to choose one diamond or the other. So we're really only integrating over half of kinematic space. And let's, just for simplicity, let's just use the geodesics on one time slice because it's easier. So let's do that. But first we need to choose which diamond for each space. So choose which half of kinematic space. And the half of kinematic space that we choose to integrate over is going to determine over what region I'm smearing my CFD operator. So if I integrate over the bottom half of kinematic space, always choosing the smaller causal diamond, then I'll get this global smearing function I described earlier. But if I instead always choose the diamond that doesn't contain some particular point, say that point, then I'll get a Poincaré smearing function, so an integral over the boundary of Poincaré ADS. But let's do the global smearing function just for simplicity here. And so the formulas here aren't important, but we just take our inversion formula in the right coordinates, plug in our geodesic operator in the right coordinates, and do the integrals, and we find that the result exactly matches the one that HKLL found. There's this extra divergent piece, but its Fourier modes don't have any overlap with the bulk mode expansion, so it's not a problem. This just vanishes, and this is what happened for HKLL as well. So we find that this local bulk operator really is instructable in terms of more natural probes which are geodesic. This is really how HKLL is seeing a bulk operator. Oh. Okay, good. So any questions about this before I go on to the CFD relationship here? So next I'll tell you how these geodesic operators are really fundamental objects in the CFD as well. And those will come from the operator product expansion. Let's go over this operator product expansion. So let's now consider a CFT in any dimension, in D dimensions. Now, there are two different equivalent bases of operators in a CFT. So the one we often work with is called the local basis. So take all the quasi-primaries in the CFT and take all their global descendants. Take all the derivatives, in other words. And this will be, but only at a single point. This is a basis for operators in the CFT. But equivalently, I could have said, take as your basis all the quasi-primaries at any point without the derivatives. And these are equivalent just by going back and forth with the Taylor expansion. So if I take a product of local quasi-primary operators in the CFT, I can expand them in one of these bases. I can expand them in this local basis, and that's commonly known as the operator product expansion, or OPE. And the only theory-dependent quantities here are the dimensions of the operators and these OPE coefficients. Everything else here, so I'm going to group these by quasi-primary. All these prefactors in front of the global descendants are just determined by conformal invariance. So let's group this. Let's group all these pieces together, and let's call this the OPE block. I'll denote that by this B of XY. So it's an operator that depends on the positions of the original two operators. So this is the object that's going to be related to the geodesic. Okay. So now I told you how to expand in the local basis. What if I want to expand in the global basis? So rather than a sum over quasi-primaries and descendants, it's going to be a sum over quasi-primaries at different points. In other words, an integral. So I'm going to sum over quasi-primaries and integrate over space. And so I'm integrating this quasi-primary, but there has to be some kernel here. You should think of these as like Clebsch-Gordan coefficients. So I'm taking a product of two representations and expanding in some other representations. What are the coefficients here? Same with these coefficients. Now, it turns out that if you just look at the transformation properties on both sides under conformal transformations, this object has to transform like a three-point function. And if an object transforms like a three-point function, it's fixed by conformal symmetry to be a three-point function. And in fact, it's just a three-point function of the original two operators with a third shadow operator, which is not necessarily a real operator in the theory. I'll denote it OK tilde. But it's an operator with dimension d minus delta, where delta was the operator was the dimension of O sub k here. And this goes back to the 70s. I learned about it from David Simmons-Duffin and Duffin's paper in 2014. So he used this sort of formalism, this kind of idea, to compute conformal blocks in the CFT. But there was an issue he had to deal with there, which was the contribution of shadow conformal blocks. So exchange of operators, not just this quasi-primary, but also the shadow corresponding to it. And the origin of that issue is the coincident limit. So if you look at this expression up here and I take x goes to y, these prefactors are dimensionful, so they have to be proportional to x minus y. So as I take x goes to y, all these descendants will drop out of the operator product expansion. And I'm left with just the quasi-primaries. But in this expression here, if I'm integrating over all space, if I'm in Euclidean CFT, say, that doesn't happen. I'm still integrating over all space, so I'm not getting this nice coincident limit. So this was the issue with the shadow formalism that David Simmons-Duffin used.
So is the shadow operator supposed to be mutually local with the physical operators?
Here I'm just using it to define this three-point function. This is just some function here that depends on these three dimensions. So you don't even need to think of this as a real operator. Just think of it as something I'm using to fix this kernel. Generally, when these operators are defined, they're defined such that the two-point function of the shadow operator and the original operator is a delta function. But really you don't need to think of this as a real operator. Just think of it as some fake that I'm using to define this kernel here. I'm not sure if that was the question. In other words, you could write this shadow operator as just some integral of the original operator with some weighting function. So it's defined in terms of the original operator. So they won't necessarily commute. Other questions about this? So, but we can fix this issue, this issue of the coincident limit. And in D equals 2, it's actually particularly simple. So in D equals 2, we can go to Lorentzian space and just integrate over the corresponding causal diamond. So if I take these two original operators, take them to be space-like separated, then they'll span some causal diamond. I just use the same kernel, but now change the integration region to be over a causal diamond instead. Now as I take the two points close together, that causal diamond shrinks to a point, so I just get quasi-primary at a point. Yeah?
So does this give the same answer as the previous page? Does B1 through K as an independent definition, right?
That's right.
Which of the two integrals gives you the right answer?
This is the one that gives you the right answer.
So why was that an integral?
So this, there was an issue with this expression. So this is not precisely true. I should have made it a question mark here. This is not precisely true because if you try to use this to compute conformal blocks, say, you'll get the wrong answer.
So how do people get to this wrong expression?
To this expression?
Yes.
So it wasn't originally written in this kind of way. There are different arguments to get to this expression, but the issue really is this coincident limit. When people were using this to understand conformal blocks, they just sort of wrote down this expression and said it obeys the conformal Casimir equation.
Okay, so for instance, equations.
Right. Okay. Right, but it doesn't. Yeah, it's conformally invariant. It solves the Casimir equation, but it doesn't give you the correct coincident limit.
Maybe it's a mutual locality because, you know, whether z is in the causal diamond of x, y changes how it should commute or not. So That's why I was asking about what are the physical property, even if it's a fake operator.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow, where are, you know,
you're
there
saying
has to be some mutual locality property that has to satisfy for these things.
For this to be well defined,
yeah.
Let's talk about that after, because I'm not sure I understand. But.
I mean, that's just a silly name for a follow-up. One of X minus Y to some power, X minus Z to some power.
Right. Yeah, this is just some function. I just introduced this operator to make it clear why this function had to be what it was. It's not just some crazy function.
Well, it's not just that. You're introducing a decomposition of the identity in your input space. So you have to show that it is a decomposition of the identity.
Right, right.
And it cannot be arbitrary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's some.
But I don't think you want to introduce a decomposition of the identity, right? It's just a name for a kernel, nothing else. I mean,
so, I don't want. Maybe it has some physical meaning, but I don't want to give it. I don't want to give it that physical meaning right now. I don't want to commit to it. But the point is just that, say if I tailor expand this operator about some particular point, then do the integral, then I'll get exactly the same coefficients here. So these two. The point is that these two are the same thing. Just think of these as Clebsch-Gordan coefficients. That's all I want you to think of them as for now. So maybe there's something more to say about them. I mean, these are interesting operators. They seem sort of like sources. So a source for this operator would generally have dimension d minus delta. So this shadow operator sounds kind of like a source. So maybe there's some physical interpretation, but I don't want to necessarily go there right now. But we should talk. I'd be happy to talk about that more. So the point is that by reducing this integration region, now everything will work out. I can write this operator product as a sum over these OPE blocks, which are integrals over the corresponding causal diamond. And the whole story will go through. But now I want you to notice that this is the same kind of object we were talking about earlier in the context of geodesic operators, the integral of some operator over a causal diamond with some kernel. And that's not a coincidence, so I'll tell you now why. And it turns out that this three-point function is precisely that kernel that I wrote down earlier, that kinematic space propagator. So now I'll tell you why that's true. So this OPE block really is an ADS3 geodesic operator. And the reason is that it obeys the same equation of motion with the same boundary condition. Okay, so I gave you two equations of motion before, so let me tell you where those come from. The first comes from the Casimir equation. So by L1 plus L2 squared here, I mean the Casimir on this bilocal. And because this OPE block is built out of a single quasi-primary, this has a definite eigenvalue under the Casimir, which I'll call C sub k. And this is the object that's identified with the mass squared in ADS3 in the context of ADS CFD. Now, in the case where those two operators, 1 and 2, are the same, I'll just drop the dependence on them. Then this Casimir is represented by a Laplacian. This is a general property about Lie groups. The Casimir operator is represented by the Laplacian on that group, and the same is true for homogeneous spaces, so for quotients of that Lie group. So here's our first equation. This is our Laplace equation for the OPE block in kinematic space. In kinematic space, because this is an object that depends on two points, that's associated with two points, so it's an operator-valued function in kinematic space. Now the second equation just comes from, the second equation is going to be this constraint equation, and that comes from the second Casimir for the 2D conformal group, which is the difference in the two, the left-moving and right-moving Casimir. And you can show that this is just given by some object that depends on h minus h bar. Right, so h minus h bar, h being the left moving dimension and h bar being the right moving dimension. So if we're talking about a scalar operator, then h minus h bar will be 0, so we get the constraint equation. Okay. So these are our two equations of motion. This matches 2 for the geodesic operator. And finally, it has simple boundary conditions. That's what I was emphasizing earlier. that as I take the coincident limit, as I go to the boundary of kinematic space, this OPE block needs to just give you a quasi-primary at a point. And indeed, it gives you just the right boundary conditions that you would want to match with the geodesic operator. So same equations of motion with the same boundary conditions here. That means that the two objects really are the same. So there's some proportionality constant. That's just some product of gamma functions. But this OPE block for scalar operators is equal to the integral of a bulk field over geodesic. And so this means that the product of boundary operators really probes a bulk geodesic. There's an alternate way of expressing the OPE, which is just instead of a sum over quasi-primaries and descendants, write it as a sum of integrals over a geodesic in some fake ADS space. If there's a real bulk dual, then it's a real ADS space. I didn't tell you about how to include tensors and multi-traces, but tensors can be included in a simple way, and multi-trace or multi-particle operators will come in when we add interaction. So I don't think I'll have time to explain that here. But in addition, we find a sort of interesting formula for the local bulk operator. Rather than just some smeared operator over some region in the CFP, we can think of it as a projected smeared bilocal. So I've just taken the inversion formula, and instead of writing the OPE block here, I've just written a projector out front and a bilocal out here. And so the details of this formula aren't too important, but the idea is we smear this bilocal in the appropriate way over just a single time slice, then project onto the field we wanted. And this gives us our HKLL. This gives us the same local bulk operator that HKLL would have given us. Any questions about that? Okay. So before I move on, I'll just explain the connection to conformal blocks. So a two-point correlator of OPE blocks is really a conformal block. The reason for that, so the conformal block, I'll call G sub K, depends on formal cross ratios, which I won't define here, is really just a four-point function projected onto a certain exchange, let's say some operator O sub K with some normalization here. And this is evaluated in the vacuum. Now, if I just take this projector and act both ways on it, then I can just replace these operator products with OPE blocks, now depending on the locations of these operators. Now, using the duality, this kinematic duality between OPE blocks and geodesic operators that I just derived for you, I can replace each of these by a bulk field. So now I have a bulk two-point function, which is just a bulk-to-bulk propagator, integrated over two geodesics. This object is really a conformal, this computes the conformal block for you. And this was previously understood by these authors as a geodesic Witten diagram. Okay. But we find that it's also a kinematic space propagator. So if you're familiar with conformal blocks in CFT2, they're just a propagator of two hypergeometric functions, a product of two hypergeometric functions. And each of those is really just a propagator in the corresponding de Sitter space in kinematic space. Okay. So with the time I have left, I'll go over some more applications and what we can do with this. Okay. But first, just to summarize what we've learned. So we found the bulk equations of motion intertwine with kinematic space equations of motion via this intertwining relation with the X-ray transform. And we found that by solving the Cauchy problem here, we can construct local bulk fields using geodesic operators. And this tells us how you can see into the bulk and how you can construct local operators from something more fundamental and diffeomorphism invariant. And moreover, we found this kinematic space, this kinematic dictionary that relates geodesic operators and OPE block. So this OPE block, which appears in the operator product expansion, is given by a field in kinematic space, and is also given by the integral of a field in ADS. So this is the beginning of a holographic dictionary with depth perception. Okay. So let me go on to the applications now. So this is, I told you earlier that there would be a relationship to the modular Hamiltonian. So let me tell you how that comes. And that really this kinematic dictionary is a generalization of the Ryotake-Nagi formula. So I defined the OPE block for you. I gave it in terms of some smeared operator for a scalar. But it turns out you can do the same thing for a tensor just by adding the correct covariant and contravariant indices here. So the OPE block for the stress tensor, the contribution to the OPE from the stress tensor and all its components and all its descendants, is just given by this appropriate integral here over the causal diamond. Now, if you do this integral, you can show that just using conservation and tricelessness of the stress tensor, that integral over the causal diamond can be squashed onto an integral just over the slice. And this is the result. And you may recognize this to be exactly the vacuum modular Hamiltonian that was originally derived by Rob et al. The vacuum modular Hamiltonian for the corresponding interval in CFP2. So this looks just like our kinematic duality from earlier. And the reason for that is I can define a generalization of the X-ray transform corresponding to a tensor instead. So I take my metric fluctuation and dot it with the tangent vector to the geodesic and integrate that over a geodesic. And we can call that the transverse X-ray transform. Now, you can show that this object obeys an equation of motion in the kinematic space for a slice, which single de Sitter, which was pointed out by Rob et al., these authors here. So the modular Hamiltonian obeys this. This is just a Casimir equation. But you can check that this area of perturbation that I just defined also obeys this equation of motion due to the Einstein equation. The modular Hamiltonian and the area of perturbation both obey the same equation of motion. You can check that they obey the same boundary conditions, so they're also the same. You can think of this as an alternate derivation of this, a perturbative version of the Ryotake-Nagi formula, or the JLMS formula. So the kinematic dictionary really generalizes the RT formula in this way. Okay. I'll just say this quickly, but this differential operator acting on the area perturbation gives us the X-ray transform of the 0-0 component of the Einstein tensor. If we're not in the vacuum, then I need to add, then this is not 0, and I get the rate transform of the energy density instead. And so the kinematic dictionary doesn't hold anymore. I need to correct it. In order to correct it, you can show that the object you need to correct it is just the integral of the stress tensor over the time slice, over some time slice of this corresponding wedge to the interval we're interested in. But this is just the one of rank correction to the Ryotake-Nagi formula, the FLM correction. And that's just the bulk vacuum modular Hamiltonian. So you can ask me for details on that later if you'd like. But the result is that really we found, for the case of scalars, we showed that in equations of motion correspond to OPE block equations, the Casimir equation. But the same is true for Einstein equations and entropy equations of motion. Via the entanglement first law, this area of perturbation, via the entanglement first law, this OPE block, just the modular Hamiltonian, which is entanglement entropy perturbation. So the Einstein equations are dual to entropy equations of motion. And now it'd be very interesting if we could generalize this to include operators other than just the metric in some non-perturbative way. So some generalization of the entanglement entropy that gives you the OPE block as a special case, but away from the vacuum still gives you the integral of an operator over a surface. Okay. So now what happens in higher dimensions? So in higher dimensions, I could consider still the space of geodesics, and the results go through. But it turns out that there's not a nice causal structure you can define on the space of geodesics in higher dimensions anymore. There's no containment relation for geodesics. But I can take time-like separated points instead. The time-like separated points do have a nice containment relation. And they correspond to minimal surfaces in the bulk. So I can instead of the X-ray transform, I can define what's called the radon transform of a field, the integral over symmetric minimal surface. And this object, and all the previous discussion we'll go through, and this time-like bilocal can be expanded in terms of OPE blocks that are smeared over the corresponding causal diamond spanned by those two points. And those are dual to integrals of a bulk field over a minimal surface. But equivalently, you can show that this object transforms, that not only can time-like bilocals, but also surface operators, spherical surface operators, can be expanded in terms of the same OPE blocks with just a different normalization in front. So surface correlators of surface operators also have a conformal block expansion. And it's the same conformal block expansion as for four-point functions. And instead of a geodesic Witten diagram, you will get a surface Witten diagram, a bulk-to-bulk operator integrated over two surfaces. So now what happens if we consider Euclidean CFT? We don't have time-like separated bilocals anymore, but you can still define spherical surface operators. And these operators can also be expanded in terms of smeared operators, now smeared over just the interior of the ball. And in the context of DS-CFT, these operators will be dual just to fields at a point in the corresponding de Sitter space. As I make the radius of this sphere bigger, I'm going forward in this time direction in the corresponding de Sitter. And again, the correlator of surface operators has an expansion in terms of de Sitter propagators now, because the kinematic space of surfaces on time slice is just a single de Sitter space. So I think this is a hint that surface operators could play a fundamental role in DS-CFT. And just briefly, since I'm out of time, let me describe what happens beyond the vacuum. So we know that generally bilocals have to encode a world line path integral. So if I want to evaluate the Feynman propagator here, it'll be given by some integral, some path integral over paths connecting those two points of e to the I times the world line action of that path. This is an equivalent formulation of quantum field theory. So now in the context of ADS-CFT, if I take the geometric optics limit, where this field is heavy but won't back react, then this tells us that the OPE has to contain world line operators, so integrals of fields over world lines. And somehow the multi-particle operators, the multi-trace operators that I didn't describe before, have to resum to produce this, to reproduce these world line operators. So I'll give you one example of where this happens. So we could consider the OPE block. We could consider an interacting OPE block where in 2D CFT I include not just a global primary but also its descendants, which I'll just call TO or T squared O. And each of these comes with some coefficient. This is not the precise coefficient, so this is just the sketch here. But now if I expand about classical background, I can take this stress tensor and expand it about some expectation value and some fluctuation. So as long as C is much greater than 1, the expectation value is order C, and the fluctuation is order root C. So this is some kind of coherent state. Then these terms will all reshuffle into some semi-classical expansion, where I get some complicated functional here. So the Virasoro OPE block has a semi-classical expansion where the first term is going to be just a smeared local operator. And you can show that the previous story goes through if we just take a quotient of the kinematic space for a Banyados geometry. Then the kinematic space is also going to be some large diffeomorphism of the original de Sitter cross de Sitter. And the Virasoro OPE blocks are going to correspond to dressed geodesic operators. So it's an object that is equivalent to a geodesic operator in any state that's the descendant of the vacuum. And it's really a bilocal dressing. It's a dressing in which sort of the gravitational Wilson lines, if you will, go only to the two endpoints of the geodesic. And in addition, the non-minimal geodesics, the entwinement geodesics, will come from winding diamond operators. Those correspond to OPE blocks where instead of where I require a different coincident limit. So the diamond winds around the cylinder, and rather than requiring that I take the coincident limit as I take those two points together, I have to wind around once before I bring them together. And so this I think says something interesting about how to probe closer and closer to the black hole horizon by considering taller and taller causal diamonds. So I'm out of time, so thanks. Strings in the bulk?
Yeah.
So this is sort of, I think this is sort of too coarse of a description to see a full string theory in the bulk, but it is true that Wilson loops, for instance, are known to compute actions of strings in the bulk. And if we're, say if we're in CFT3 ADS4, then these Wilson loops are exactly the surface operators I just. If I consider a spherical Wilson loop, then I'll find that it's dual to some surface operator in the same way. So I think it gives you a signature of, and that should be true in any dimension. But so I think it gives you a signature of strings, but it doesn't. I don't think it can really tell you that there is a string theory in the bulk.